make sure it gets all the way around.
Well, you know, when Ross and Mary took leadership here in the class, this is when we saw the Skeptic Swarms launched. And Ross, I really appreciate the creativity you brought to that ministry and look forward to your continued involvement there, because I know you got a lot more good ideas. So look forward to that very much. Well, happy July 1st. This is Canada's Independence Day. Yay! Well, at least one fellow Canadian here in the class. So, and how many of you are going to a wedding next Saturday? Well, I saw this on the net that next Saturday is going to be the biggest Christian wedding day of all time. More than three times as many weddings as normal. Yeah, it's July 7th, 07, 777. So apparently, some pastors are doing as many as seven wedding ceremonies next Saturday because so many people want to get married on that particular day. So, all right. Well, let me give you a brief report. I mean, I really appreciated all the prayers I got from this class for the debate I had with Victor Stenger. And, you know, that was this past Tuesday. And he's the one who's authored this book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, with a subtitle, How Science Shows That God Does Not Exist. And so he was being interviewed on a couple of major stations in Houston and Dallas. And fortunately, the host there knew who I was, and they said, well, we got to have him. So I was on there with Vic Stenger and these two hosts talking about his book. He wanted to talk about my book, but we said, no, we're going to talk about your book. And I think that was a good strategy there. And this is in line with a number of books that have come out this year from atheist scientists, basically taking a whole new strategic approach in their discussion of atheism. That rather than saying that atheism is defensible, they're taking the offense. It started off with Richard Dawkins and his book, The God Delusion, where he launched his new quest to rid the planet of belief in God and those who follow or worship some kind of religion, actually labeling people believe in God as being evil. In fact, Richard Dawkins went so far as to say that even Mother Teresa was evil, because through her good works, she was giving credence to those who were using religion and belief in God for evil purposes. And really, the only good people in the world are the atheists. Well, a number of people jumped on the bandwagon. And actually, I think what's going on, because this is the fifth book out this year with this kind of a theme of take the offense, is that these people have discovered they can sell a lot of books. And guess who's buying books like this? Not the atheists. It's Christians that are buying this. And, like Sam Harris, for example, is on a church speaking circuit. He's going to major churches speaking about atheism and knowing that if he puts his books out there, all these Christians will buy his books so they can read it and refute the nonsense. So now, I would agree it's filled with nonsense, but I find it seems to be a marketing strategy is working really well for them. This book was 6 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And, Richard Dawkins book, I don't know how many months, it was the number one bestseller. But again, what's interesting is that it's evangelical Christians that are buying these books so that they can, quote, be better equipped. And by the way, I'm not saying that isn't bad. However, in looking at all these books, I could probably summarize their approach is that it's bombastic, it's shallow, without any real evidence. And this book is kind of like Dawkins' book, and it's filled with straw man arguments. But, I did prepare myself by listening to some web messages from Victor Stenger. He's been interviewed by some atheist organizations. And he's different from Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins just comes across as a really nasty guy. That's not Victor Stenger. His public persona is one of, you know, Mr. Nice Guy, I'm reasonable, show me the evidence, I'll become a Christian, that kind of approach. But when you read his book, you can see that he's taking great pains to avoid dealing with the evidences that really count. He basically takes the approach of taking various Christian apologetics arguments and selecting out that which he feels he can respond to. And he does the same thing with Bible verses. He will claim that there's certain statements in the Bible that are utterly contradictory or prove that the Bible is not reliable, but he ignores the verse right afterwards, which really answers the objection. I'll give you one example. You know, he picks up on that. Well, I think almost every atheist picks up on this, where Jesus makes a statement in the Gospels, where he says to his disciples, some of you that are standing here will see me come in my glory before this generation dies out. And as Dawkins pointed out, Victor Stenger quotes the verse. Dawkins doesn't, but he quotes the verse and said, obviously this didn't happen. Therefore, Jesus' words were not true. The Bible is false. The Bible has no credibility. And this is exactly what we'd expect if there really is no God that exists. Now, where do you find that passage? Yeah. I mean, you can find it, and I think it's what, Matthew 16, it's in Mark, it's in Luke, it's in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. And, you know, what's amazing is you just read the very next verse and it answers the question. Now, I think what's unfortunate is at least, you know, when it comes to the Matthew passage, let me see if I can find this quickly here. Yeah, here we go. Where I think people have stumbled on this one is that there's a chapter break between the last verse of Matthew 16 and the first verse of Matthew 17. And by the way, this happens in Mark and Luke as well. And by the way, when the Bible was penned, there were no chapter breaks. There were no verses, no chapter breaks. They're arbitrary. But if I were just to read to you the last part of Matthew 16, he says, for the Son of Man is going to come in His Father's glory with His angels, and then He'll reward each person according to what he has done. This is the last verse. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. And Victor Stenger says, we've been waiting 2,000 years. He hasn't come yet. Clearly, this proves that this isn't true. But look what it says at the beginning of verse 7, chapter 17. After 6 days, Jesus took with Him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There He was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became as white as the light. Just then that there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my Son, whom I love. With Him I'm well pleased. Listen to Him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, He said, don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus, and Jesus was no longer in His transfigured state. So, in just 6 days, what Jesus said at the end of Matthew 16 was fulfilled. And, you know, when He was speaking at the end of Matthew 16, He was speaking to the 12. And He said, some of you, some of the 12 will see this before you die. 6 days later, 3 of them did that very thing. And the fact is, this is repeated 3 times in the New Testament. So that's just an example of the kind of scholarship you see here. And that's what I think got me a little upset about the book, is how often this was done in the book, over and over again. And, you know, he uses my name in the book because he tries to pick apart the major Christian apologists. And I notice he did that repeatedly whenever he quoted my works. You know, he says, Hugh Ross didn't take into account this. Well, it's actually in the book if you read that particular passage. And he spent quite a bit of time critiquing some material I wrote 35 years ago. So, well, it was 34 years ago. It wasn't that far and long ago. But it's a piece I wrote on fulfilled prophecy. And I can tell you, 34 years ago, people were very interested in what the Bible said about future history. Today, they seem to be more interested in what the Bible says about future science. But where he critiqued me, as well as Josh McDowell and Bill Craig, has said, you know, every time these Christian apologists talk about the Bible successfully fulfilling prophecy, it's always a prophecy that you find evidence for by going to the Bible. And he gave several examples where Bill Craig and Josh McDowell and myself would quote a verse from the Old Testament, kind of like what we're talking about, Isaiah. You know, Isaiah makes these predictions about what the coming of the Messiah will be like. And so where do you see that fulfilled? You see it fulfilled in the New Testament. And what Victor Stinger, he's got a whole chapter on this. He says, you know, this does not go well for the Christian community. They're using the Bible to prove that the Bible is true. They're using the Bible to prove that God is true. And nowhere in their writings do they ever give a prophecy where the evidence for the fulfillment is outside the Bible. Well, that patently is false. I mean, the thing I published 34 years ago, probably about 75% of the evidences I gave are cases where the fulfillment, the evidence for the fulfillment is outside the Bible. And I checked Bill Craig's, about half of his are, and the case of Josh McDowell, about two-thirds of his are. And, you know, here we have Victor Stinger claiming to read all this stuff, but clearly he only picked out those examples that fit the case he made. And it's a lot of what I see going on in apologetics. They're counting on the fact that their readers aren't going to read our stuff. So they take his word for it. When he says that Hugh Ross didn't give any examples where the fulfillment had evidence from outside the Bible, they just assume that he must be right. And same thing with Josh McDowell and Bill Craig. Now, what was wonderful about the radio debate is that actually came up. Because the host said, well, you got a whole chapter here where you critique Dr. Ross on his statements about fulfilled prophecy. Can you review for the audience what these are? Then he asked me to respond. And so I had an opportunity to respond. Actually, part of that response is something that's in the lesson for this morning on Psalm 33. I gave the example of the book of Daniel and how in the book of Daniel, it predicts all this future history. And the evidence for that fulfillment is not in the Bible. It's from extra-biblical sources. And basically what you've got Daniel doing is predicting in considerable detail the future historical events in the Persian Empire, followed by the events of Alexander the Great and what would happen to the Greek Empire, and it ends up with the Romans coming in. So it gives you a sweep of about 300 years of history. Now, the critique of that has been, well, Daniel was not the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. The skeptic said this Daniel was probably some Roman Catholic priest who lived in the 5th century A.D. And, of course, he had all the history books he could look at and make it look like this was fulfilled prophecy and put Daniel's name on it so people would think it was a Daniel at Nebuchadnezzar's court. Now, I use the same argument you did, Dave. I said, that won't wash anymore because they have found fragments of the book of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which means that Daniel must have been written previous to the 2nd century B.C. By the way, there's other evidence. The book of Daniel is not entirely written in Hebrew. Parts of it are written in Aramaic. And when you look at the Aramaic, it's got the style of ancient Aramaic rather than the Aramaic of the Roman times or the post-Roman times. So there you've got two pieces of evidence, the writing style and the fact that they appeared in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls establish that while the Dead Sea Scroll date for these fragments on Daniel were 2nd century B.C. So that means that the Daniel that wrote this material had to be previous to the 2nd century B.C., which means it really must be the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court, because if it was any other Daniel, the contemporaries would be able to blow the fraud quite easily. It's one thing if you got 1,000 years separating the events, but if you only got 1 century or 2 separating the events, it's far more difficult to try to pin someone else's name on what you write without you being exposed. And therefore, scholars today, both liberal and conservative, concede that the book of Daniel indeed must have been written by the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court, in which case he really was accurately predicting future historical events in a considerable detail. Now, at one point, too, Stinger made the point that, you know, nowhere in the Bible does it talk about Big Bang cosmology. I guess he hadn't read what I knew he had read the 2nd edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, because he wrote a major critique of that book, but I guess he didn't bother to read the 3rd edition. So in there we have a chapter about, you know, Big Bang, the Bible said it first. So and then what was fun is I got to lay all that out, and then the host said, well, Victor, what do you think about that? And he just changed the subject. Didn't want to talk about it at all. And the same thing happened when we talked about the origin of life. Well, you know, his approach is a little different. He obviously wasn't aware that Fuzz and I had wrote this book on the origins of life. So I had a chance to kind of give him a very brief summary of what was in that book, and also announce that the book has been positively reviewed by one of the world's leading origin of life researchers who happens to be an atheist. So the fact that we got a positive review from one of the atheist origin of life researchers. And then again, he was asked what he thought of Bunny. He says, well, I got no comment except to say that everything Dr. Ross has said is not true. But no evidence. And so I just had a chance to say, well, our book is out there. You can check out the citations. We cite the original literature. You can decide for yourself who is right and who is wrong. So that's kind of how the debate went. We are going to put it up on our website. The debate was recorded. So we're going to give you both the original uncut version of the debate, as well as the edited debate that went on the air this morning. So early this morning, it was aired in Houston and in Dallas, and will be given to a number of other radio stations as well. The only negative critique I got about the debate is that we had two hosts, one who read this book and one who did not. And the one that did not kept interrupting and trying to take on Victor Stenger. Now, Victor Stenger is a theoretical physicist, and he's done some really credible research. And here was this lady who hadn't read his book, didn't have any degrees in science, and she thought she could take him on. And, you know, I kept wondering, well, what am I here for? I mean, but one thing I've learned about radio is you've got to be polite with the host. So I tried to behave myself in that way. But that's the gist of the debate, and I thought it went really well, and I really do appreciate your prayers. And I'm also thinking there may be some hope for this Victor Stenger, just because he doesn't take quite the nasty attitude that you get from people like Jerry Coyne and Richard Dawkins. And he also tipped his hand, not in the book. He's very cagey in the book, but in a couple of the interviews I listened to, where he was interviewed by atheist hosts, he did let it be known that he was raised as a Roman Catholic. He was forced to go to Mass every week, and he was also forced to become a choir boy, and that he had some bitter experiences about which he didn't talk about. And that's so common with people who are scholars and atheists, is that they usually can be traced back to some kind of a bitter experience with the organized church sometime in their youth. And it'd be good if we would ever have an opportunity to talk to him about that. So appreciate your prayers for Victor Stenger, because he really is a nice guy. I think there may be, he's in his 80s too, so there may not be that much time. Okay. I wanted to give you a quick announcement not a lot of detail, but just an announcement about a major breakthrough in astrophysics. And it's announced in this latest issue of the Astrophysical Journal. This came out 2 days ago and came out Friday. But what it announces is the discovery of a brand new kind of star that they had never seen before. And the authors here refer to this new type of star as a primordial nova, but I'm sure the astronomical community will give it a different kind of name. Because what they have found are stars that are kind of halfway between supernova and novae. And I say, what's the big deal difference? Well, when a supernova erupts, it erupts with a light output of about 200 billion stars. They're really dramatic events. And you look at photographs of them, a single star will outshine the entire galaxy in which it is embedded. And these supernova explode into interstellar space, huge amounts of ashes from their stellar burning. And actually all of us in this room are the products of supernova ashes. It's supernova that make the most of the heavy elements, elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. So our planet is made from the ashes of supernova as well as our bodies. But what astronomers have been doing over the past 30 years is trying to figure out what kind of stellar explosive events are responsible for each of the elements that we see here on planet Earth and that make up our biology. And over the past several decades, they have figured out that there are three different kinds of supernova eruptions. I won't go into the three different kinds, but each kind makes a different suite of heavy elements, metals and radioactive elements. And in addition to that, you've got what are called asymptotic giant branch stars. Again, I won't go into the details of what that's all about. These are basically stars that don't go supernova, but they're fairly large stars, and when they get to the end of their burning cycle, they generate these powerful stellar winds. And these stellar winds carry out a lot of the lighter material. Not things as heavy as uranium and thorium and lead, but a lot of the lighter metals are carried out by that kind of wind. And then there's another suite of elements essential for life that are made by what are called binary white dwarf stars. These are burnt-out stars that orbit about one another, and if they orbit about one another closely enough, they will send out a stream of fluorine gas. Now, this is important because the supernova don't make fluorine. The asymptotic giant branch stars don't make fluorine. And I know fluorine is a rat poison, but you need a little bit of it in your diet in order to be able to live a healthy life and even to live in the first place. It is a life essential element. Well, this is a new discovery of a brand new kind of star that provides us with metals. Now, the metals it provides us with are metals that you can get from other kinds of stars, a supernova. But there's been a problem over the last several years in that the three different kinds of supernova don't quite make up the quantity of certain metals that we see on the Earth today. I mean, the Earth formed when the universe was only 9.2 billion years old, and 9.2 billion years was calculated not to be quite enough time to make the full quantity of the elements that we see in our solar system. Well, now this new kind of star solves the problem. You say, how come we only ever saw this until now? Well, these are termed primordial novae, which means that you only see them when the universe is really young. And if you're only seeing them when the universe is young, the only way you're going to detect them is to look like 10, 12 billion light years away. In fact, these are predominant when the universe is about 12 to 13 billion, or pardon me, 12 to 13 billion years ago. So when the universe is about 1 to 2 billion years old, that's when these stars are predominant. And that means you've got to look so far away, you're going to need a really powerful telescope to see them. And this is what this is announcing, how to use this new instrument to be able to pick up the first one of these stars, but they're able to analyze the spectrum and say, this makes up the missing material. Now, if you're interested in what that missing material is, well, it makes, I got the list right here. Here we go. Okay, it makes carbon 13, oxygen 17, and nitrogen 15. So it makes strange isotopes of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen. Not the ones that are most common, but we've been wondering for a long time, where do all these strange isotopes of carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen come from? Now we know where they come from. But in terms of stuff we really need, because light doesn't use those elements. It uses the regular isotopes of like carbon 12 instead of carbon 13, hydrogen 14 instead of nitrogen 15, and oxygen 18 instead of oxygen 17. However, it makes up enormous quantities of calcium, titanium, copper, and zinc. And those are life essential elements, and you know, titanium is kind of nice to have around for industrial purposes, as well as the copper. In fact, all of these are important for industrial purposes. So it makes up the deficit. And the paper ends by saying, we think we now know where all the elements come from. However, it introduces a fine-tuning argument. In order for advanced light to be possible at the one time in the universe when an advanced life can exist, and that's something we've been writing on, there's an extremely narrow window of time in the history of the universe where you can have advanced life, namely when the universe is about 13.7 to 13.8 billion years old. If it's younger than that or older than that, then you're not going to have the possibility of human beings. Bacteria, yes, but not human beings. And the trick is to get all these elements in place at the quantities you need in the time window. They have to be here on planet Earth when the universe is just 9.2 billion years old. So you've got to make these things quickly enough that they can be used by advanced life, which introduces a fine-tuning argument. That means you have to have a certain number of these primordial novae exploding at that point in the history of our Milky Way galaxy. Now, if they explode in another galaxy, that's not going to help. They'll just stay in that galaxy. This is stuff that's got to be happening in our galaxy. And what astronomers have yet to do, this is just the first discovery, is to look at different galaxies and see whether or not you get any variation in the number density of these primordial novae. But what is clear is you will have to fine-tune the number and the geography of these primordial novae in order for advanced light to be possible. So one more fine-tuning argument, and it, again, is something that came up in the debate. What I loved about the debate was we were able to get Victor Stenger to agree to a test. He kept saying, Christianity can't be put to the test. Belief in God can't be put to the test. But I proposed a test, and the host says, what do you think of the test? And I said, yeah, I think it's a good test. And the test he agreed to was that, you know, if the Christian worldview is right, then scientists should discover increasing evidence for design as they continue to study the universe. But Victor Stenger was confident that as astronomers continue to study the universe, the design evidence will disappear. It will go away, and the evidence will decline. Well, I mean, I thought this is a major breakthrough because I've yet to hear an atheist agree to that test. And he actually agreed to it and says, oh, yeah, it's a great test. In fact, what he says, I knew it was going to probably happen because he actually says that in the book, that one of the ways we can prove in the future that Christianity is false is we're going to see all this evidence for the anthropic principle disappear. The design evidence will go away. So, well, in the Astrophysical Journal, we have one evidence just this very week that apparently the evidence for design is getting stronger rather than weaker. Okay, let's look at Psalm 33. You know, I'm going to move over to here so my cards don't fall out. I get teased by my wife a lot about all these business cards I throw inside my Bible with notes on them so I can figure out what's going on. But last week, we were able to finish up our discussion on Psalm 33, verse 7, where Psalm 33 reflects on the events of the third creation day. you know, where it talks about how God takes this planet Earth that in its primordial state had water over the whole face of the earth where there were no continents. And as you see in Genesis chapter 1, creation day 3, God separates the waters, and so we have oceans and continents separate from one another, and how this is one of many places in the Bible indicates that this is a permanent feature of the planet once you get past creation day 3. So if you recall from last week, we went into 6 different passages of the Bible that establish that indeed this is permanent. You say, why do we have to all this trouble? Well, one of the major debates going on in the Christian community has to do with the extent of the flood. Is the flood global, or is it worldwide? And you know that fascinating study we had here that there's really a difference between global and worldwide? You know, the Romans, Paul said their faith had been heard throughout the whole world. But he's referring to the Roman world, not the entire globe. And, you know, this is one of several passages that tell us that indeed, once God sets up these continents, that never again will the water cover the whole face of the earth, which means the flood of Noah cannot be global in extent, but it certainly can be worldwide in wiping out all of humanity and all the birds and mammals associated with humanity, except for those on board the ark. So that's verse 7. We want to move on to verse 8. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere him. And, you know, this is kind of a dividing point here in the sense that what the psalmist has been speaking about up to this point are God's physical creation miracles. And saying, you know, God has done this. We know he has done this. We can trust that he can and does do these kinds of things. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. Now this is one of many places where it talks about God's creation miracles as flowing from the mouth of the Lord. If he wants something to happen, he can speak it into existence. If he wants something to be removed, he can speak it out of existence. So for example, these creation accounts tell us that when God created the universe, he spoke it into existence. When we get to the last creation account, Revelation 20, 21, and 22, it tells us that when the universe has fulfilled its purpose, then God will remove it by speaking it out of existence. So God can speak and create things. He can also speak and remove that which he has created. So what we have here in verse 9, for he spoke and it came to be, he commanded and it stood firm. The Lord foils the plans of the nations, verse 10. He thwarts the purposes of the peoples. But the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. And just a word here that in the Old Testament, they don't have a word for forever that means only for all eternity. No such word exists in the Hebrew. So whenever you see that word forever, it can indeed mean for all of eternity. It can also mean for a very long period of time. So, for example, it speaks of the Aaronic priesthood as lasting forever. But it also tells us in the Old Testament that the Aaronic priesthood will be replaced. There's no contradiction there. The Aaronic priesthood indeed lasted for many, many generations. So, but the whole point here is that what God decides is going to happen. There's going to be no dissuading God from what he decides to do. And what I thought we would do today, because what this whole psalm is doing is contrasting what God does in the physical creation with what he does in the affairs of human beings. And just as he can speak and make things happen in terms of the physical creation, he does the same thing in the affairs of human beings. And if he wants a certain government or nation to do something, he simply has to speak and it will happen. It doesn't matter what Congress decides. I mean, when God figures out what's going to happen, it's going to happen that particular way. Now, this doesn't relieve us of responsibilities as human beings from fulfilling the desires of God for a country. We are responsible. This is one of the many passages of the Bible which tells us we are free will beings. We're held responsible to do the will of God, but God has already decided what's going to happen. And he's going to make it happen regardless of what we human beings think or do. He is in control. He is in charge. And if you were with our class 25 years ago, we went through the entire Bible and looked up all the passages that deal with the resolution of human free will and predestination. I don't intend to repeat that because it's covered in one of our books over here in the table, Beyond the Cosmos. Different ways you can resolve that paradox. And you don't have to invoke open theism or this idea of middle knowledge where God doesn't know everything or is not in control of everything. You really can have God predestinating every word we speak, every thought we think, every action we perform, and still maintain our human free will and keep us responsible for all the decisions and actions and thoughts that we perform. And as we move a little later down in Psalm 33, you're going to pick up in verse 15 and 16 that indeed God is aware of every thought we think and in control of every thought we think. And so there really is no easy way of resolving this paradox of free will and predestination from a human perspective. That's the message I've given Beyond the Cosmos. If you're willing to transcend the limits of length, width, height, and time, there are numerous solutions to divine predestination and human free will. You don't have to compromise even one. However, what I wanted to do is just spend some time today looking at a few passages of Scripture which make it clear that indeed God is in control of the nations, the politics, the wars, the peace, the taxes, everything. He is in control of all that. And, the passage that I like to do this with, well, first of all, let me give you some doctrinal passages out of the book of Proverbs, and then we'll get into Daniel, the passage I actually used in my debate with Victor Stenger. But if you go to the book of Proverbs, let me first take you to Proverbs 21, verse 1. And it tells us there that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a water course wherever he pleases. In other words, if you're not happy with the decisions of George Bush, then who are you to blame? You can blame the Lord. He is in control. Pick any president. Nixon, pick the one you hate the least. He's in control there. Pick the one you like the most. He's also in control there. He directs it like a water course wherever he pleases. You say, well, why would a good, loving God force politicians to make decisions that aren't wise? Well, this is something you're going to see when we look at the book of Daniel, is that God uses the unwise decisions of each one of us for his purpose. That really encourages me as a father. Look at all the bad decisions I've made in trying to raise up my sons and recognize, even my bad decisions, God is in control of and God is using it for the benefit of my sons. Whenever they get into trouble, likewise I realize in some respect that's for their benefit. It might take some time to figure that out. I'm still trying to figure out why all the bad things in my life are for my own benefit. So, but the whole point is we have assurances in the Word of God that this is indeed the case. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a water course wherever he pleases. Now, these Proverbs aren't isolated statements of wisdom. Sometimes people read the book of Proverbs that way. It's like every single verse they read in isolation with every other verse. You really do need to look at the entire book of Proverbs as a consistent flow. There's messages being taught throughout here. And again, there are no chapter breaks in the original. And one of the ways I want to demonstrate that is just take it back a few verses and see how statements in Proverbs 20 relate to the first verse of Proverbs 21. Now, there's actually several here in chapter 20, but I'm just going to pick up one here to try to make the point. And that would be verse 24. It says, a man's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? Interesting comment. We human beings all think we're in control of the way we're going. I decide where to go this morning, I go there. But here we have a verse that says, a man's steps are directed by the Lord. Now, how many of you in coming to church today really felt that God was interfering in your life and taking you to a spot where he didn't want to go? I don't think any of us came here with that kind of thinking. It's like, I got up, had breakfast, put my clothes on, got into the car, got here, and I decided to do all that thing. I'm doing what I want to do. And yet here's a passage that says that, no, that's not the way it works. The Lord is the one that directed you to come to this class this morning. For some strange reason, that's the way it works out. And then it makes the point, how can we understand this? Well, I think this is a passage I used in, you know, doing the book of Beyond the Cosmos, is that we have told to us right here in Scripture, this is not easy for us to understand. We live our lives really not thinking about how God is directing both my good decisions and my bad decisions to bring about His purpose, not only in my life, but the life of other people. I mean, the thing I try to bring out in Beyond the Cosmos is that God is actually directing who you meet, when you meet them, and where you meet them. Because He's not only interested in trying to form and shape your life and direct your life, He wants to use you to direct the lives of other people. And so He'll move you into strange places. And, you know, I think most of you here are old enough to appreciate you've probably had a few experiences like that in your life where you say, you know, I never really intended to meet that person, but somehow against my will it happened. I wound up meeting this person and having this conversation. Well, it's an evidence that God is directing your path. And the older you get, the more you can look back in your life and say, I've had quite a few experiences like that. And it tells you that God's in control. Yes. Well, I can't pull it off the top of my head right now. When we were studying the book of Job, there was a place there where God claimed that He was in control of evil, that He was in charge. And when evil things happen, it does not happen outside His will. Now, does He take personal responsibility for the evil deed? No, He just says, I am in control, I am sovereign, this wouldn't have happened unless I wanted it to happen. However, the evil deed is done by evil people or evil angels. God is good. He can't do anything that's evil. But it made it very clear, this is not something where God says, oops, I didn't intend this to happen. This was totally under His control. Moreover, in that passage of Job, it's making a point when God makes that claim that He is in complete control of the evil that's being performed in the face of the earth, that He's using that evil to bring about the good that He intends. And Job is a prime example. Look at all the evil that came into Job's life. But God used all that for a good purpose. Not just for Job's benefit and the benefit of Job's wife, not just for the benefit of the four men that he was debating, but for our benefit 3,500 years later. I mean, we get to benefit from the experiences that God put him through. Well, I think what you're struggling with is something that's common to everyone in this class. It's Proverbs 16:24. What's the second half of the verse? It says, how then can anyone understand his own way? I mean, this is the way God operates. How am I to understand the actions and the thoughts and the words that I express throughout the day? You know, God's control. Am I a robot? No, I'm not a robot. I can definitely sense that I'm not robotic. And yet, to some degree, God's pulling all the strings to make sure that what happens in my life is exactly what He intends. Is this difficult to appreciate and understand? Extraordinarily so. Yeah. I mean, we have lots of evidence that both the predestination aspect of what the Bible teaches is true. We have lots of evidence that the free will part is true. Trying to see how they fit together in a completely harmonious way is difficult to understand. That you could probably put in the phrase, impossible to understand. And that's the claim I tried to make in Beyond the Cosmos. We can come to some understanding, but we can't come to a complete understanding. The solutions I offered are possibly correct solutions. I can't prove that they are the one and only solution. because God obviously has several different options to make this work. We run into the same difficulty with the Trinity. We can come to some partial understandings of how God manifests himself as an essence and as persons, but we can't come to a complete understanding. And when we're left with a number of options. Well, I think that's the conclusion you're drawing, is that we don't have to understand this to the depth to be able to act upon it. It means the physicists are under the same problem. I can't claim that I understand the full workings of gravity. We haven't even seen gravitons or gravity waves yet. So how can we claim that? And yet every physicist I know implicitly trusts his life and his experiments to the law of gravity. And so in that sense, we have faith in gravity, even though we don't totally understand it. By the same token, we can have faith in God, we can have faith in what this Bible says, because we understand enough to realize this is true. And if it's true, I need to act accordingly. Okay, Steve. Right. Although in one sense I can say I can't completely understand this because this problem of evil is more than a human problem. After all, we had the angels sinning before God created humanity. So there is that problem of evil. We also got passages in the New Testament that tell us that the good angels, those that are still in league with God, are intently observing us in order to understand this grace that God is giving us. We get to experience the grace directly. They have to observe it. And so that tells me that these angels are struggling in the same manner we are to really try to appreciate how God is going to resolve this problem of evil and suffering. They're in the same camp we are. They're trying to figure it out. We're trying to figure it out. But if we realize, just let me finish, if we realize that this problem of evil is bigger than just our human context, then we appreciate there could be factors involved in this that make it a lot more complicated than we realize. And if we realize who God is, then we're going to give him some room. And you know, this is my complaint with Victor Stenger. He's got two chapters on the problem of evil and how Christians have terrible answers for it. But the whole point is he's trying to analyze the problem of evil as if it only involves us human beings. And from a Christian perspective, that's not true. And therefore, these kinds of rather insipid solutions that are being offered, we can readily acknowledge. By the way, every critique here he's got of Christians' attempts to resolve the problem of evil, I agree with him. They're terrible attempts, but they're not the only attempts. What bothers me about this book is there's some very good work done by Christian scholars on the problem of evil and suffering that he simply ignores. He just goes after the bad attempts. Right? Well, Steve, I've often used that passage as an argument that we Christians should not separate ourselves from the evil in this world. That God had intended us that we would remain mixed together, because, you know, who do we know who's going to come to the Lord and who's not going to come to the Lord? So stay mixed up with the secular, with the evil, because you don't know where God's Spirit is going to go. We won't know until the time of the end. And evidently from this passage, that was God's intent all along, that the two would stay thoroughly mixed until the time of the end, and then God would separate the evil first. Now, there's something in that theology that mystifies me. Evidently, at the time of the end, God's going to leave the righteous alone, and he's going to deal with the evil first. Then he's going to deal with the righteous. Interesting point to think about. There's a hand somewhere around here. No? One back here. Do I think Solomon's in heaven? Well, that's kind of like the question. Is Adam in heaven? Is Solomon in heaven? Well, you know, I think if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, it's difficult not to have some empathy for this man Solomon, especially since we live in a rich nation. Here's a guy who kind of tried everything as a way to gain fulfillment and pleasure. But what gives me hope for King Solomon is, look at chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. After he had dissipated his life on all these things where he found no meaning and fulfillment, he finally draws the conclusion, the only way is to put your faith and trust in God. Everything else is meaningless. That's kind of the bottom line message of the book of Ecclesiastes. That indicates to me that he must have repented at the end of his life from all of that dissipation. And, you know, he had good roots. And the thing I often tell parents when they have wayward children, it's so often that they'll return to the roots. They will come back from the roots that, you as a parent, you've put this foundation in your children's lives, people around them have, and they may be like Solomon and pursue a life of dissipation for a time. But don't be surprised if they come back to their roots. And sometimes it takes a long time. And that's a prayer that any parent in that position should make. Just say, Lord, just bring them back to their roots. So, rather than, you know, crucifying yourself and saying, you know, if I had done X, Y, and Z, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Hey, your child is a free will being. You can't force them. In the same manner that you're a free will being. But keep praying for him. That's what Job did for his children. They had parties every time. You'll notice that at the very beginning of the book of Job, he said his children would get together and have parties with their friends, which gives me some pause because that's something my boys love to do. I like to have all their friends come over, and 2 o'clock in the morning they're having a barbecue in our backyard. So, keeping all the neighbors awake. But what did Job do when his children were having a party with all their friends? He prayed for them. And he prayed that they would be shielded from evil and temptation. So I'm taking great comfort from that as I try to go to sleep in the midst of all this noise in our backyard. In the back there. What to me is the key to resolving the problem of evil and suffering is to realize that if you want love in the universe, and clearly God did, then you can't create robots. You have to create free will beings. If you create free will beings, there will be the possibility that they choose rebellion rather than obedience. But if they choose rebellion, it's simply a matter of time before some free will being does it. Is there a way that God can use that rebellion to bring about a conquest of evil and suffering so it will never happen again? And that's the message of this book. God has a plan to make that happen. Yes. And it's not always that easy to figure out which is which. So, that takes discernment. You know, and this passage is also making the point that, you know, the people who fall in that category, we may be rather surprised when we're at the kingdom of heaven. Who's in that category and who's not. So many that we think should be first are actually going to be last and the other way around. And it's difficult. And you're right. The evil does have a role in that discernment. So, but there's other roles too. Obviously, we're not going to be able to resolve the problem of evil and suffering in the last minute of this class. So we will leave that. And I never even got to Daniel. We'll get to Daniel next week. But you know, this passage we're going to look at in Daniel 10 and 11 and 12, it's where Daniel prophesies in amazing detail what's going to happen in future history. And it really does illustrate this point. God's in control. He's in complete control. Let me show you the detail in which he's going to control future events. That's the message of Daniel. So you have a chance, read those 3 chapters before next week, and then we'll get to that. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had in your word. Thank you, Lord, that this book that we have in front of us speaks to all generations across dozens of generations of time and is a message that speaks to our heart that doesn't speak to the hearts of other generations. Lord, speak to us as we study these passages, and Father, we may find things that we can apply that will enable us to see the ministry path you've carved out for each one of us as individuals. And Father, I pray that between now and next week, you would give us divine opportunities. You would direct our steps and guide our paths and bring across our path people that we otherwise would not intend to meet or talk to. And Father, by your Spirit, may you use those opportunities for your light to shine into dark places. In Jesus' name, amen.